Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. Thank you for joining me for today's SMIE Consulting Midweek Roundup. It's Wednesday, June 26, 2019, and today we're coming to you with three stories live on the Facebook page for SMIE Consulting, and we're going to be taking a look today at how these three issues are going to be impacting potentially your international enrollment plans. Now, we've seen a lot over the last few years regarding, particularly with the Trump administration's policies related to travel bans and cutting programs and delaying things and all the wonderful things we know that they're capable of. So what we're going to do today is take a look at how some of those are potentially impacting what you do in international education circles. So thank you very much for joining me today. For those of you who haven't been with us before on the Midweek Roundup, this is our opportunity each Wednesday to profile and talk a little bit more in depth about three stories that have crossed our news feeds in the last 7 days or so. And we do that as a result of what we do at Social Media and International Education Consulting in terms of our public service to our colleagues in international education and social media circles to help develop your own policies and be aware of issues that might be impacting what you do in international education. So as always, I've posted the links to our SMIE Consulting website, smieconsulting.org, and our newsletter. Our newsletter is called All the SMIE News Fit to Share, comes out Mondays each week. And that gives you a list of my takes on about 10 to 12 international ed stories and about 4 to 5 social media stories each week. And we take three of those international ed stories from each Monday's edition and profile those here on the SMIE Consulting Midweek Roundup. So we're glad you're joining us today, and thanks for any contributions to the discussions that you're able to make today. Certainly, we want to recognize those of you who are certainly either watching this on our YouTube channel or catching the podcast later on. Thanks again for keeping SMIE Consulting a part of what you do in your international education work. So very glad to know you all, and glad to be connecting with you today. So let's jump right in. There are three stories we want to cover today, and it seems to rhyme in terms of what we'll be covering. OPT delays, STEM-saving MBAs, and counting Canadian international students, so the last one's a little bit of a stretch, but hopefully you get the idea there. Now, in terms of what the first story on the docket today is about, and this is the inappropriately named title to this story, Visa Delays at Background Immigration Service Strand International Students. It's coming from the New York Times. And for those who are in international education, certainly you know that USCIS does not do visa processing. They are in charge of immigration services, and particularly those that relate to international students, things like OPT, work authorization beyond the typical OPT work, emergency work authorization, and other factors related to what international students' benefits are here in the United States. So the story kind of makes you think these are incoming students, but they're not at all. These are students who are finishing their degrees, who have applied for OPT, optional practical training, and are now waiting for their employment authorization documents, their EAD cards, to come in the mail that allow them to work up to a year for those with non-STEM degrees, and potentially up to 3 years after the first year. They can reapply for 2 additional years if they're in a solid job and have employer approval for that. Now, this visa delays story, again, misnamed visa delays, but this story of OPT delays is really, in terms of the processing of these, the general rule is international students can apply for OPT 90 days in advance of when they might, of their graduation date or their end of studies date. And that's, I take that back. It's 90 days in advance of when they are planning to start their degrees, or excuse me, finish to start their work, and typically having a job offer is supposed to make that process go sooner, but 90 days in advance of their final semester, in their final semester of studies, is perhaps a little bit ambitious, even on the best of days. So right now they can only apply up to 90 days, 3 months before they want to start work. And most students don't have a job offer at the time of applying for their OPT authorization because it takes so long. And job offers typically aren't going to be found that far in advance of when they might want to start. So that 3 month time has been the normal, and to be honest, has been for the past few years, has been kind of the running time that most OPT applications are taking. With between that 60 and 90 day period is when most of them are getting approved. So up until this year, that hasn't been a major issue. It is this summer, and the story relates several students from East Coast schools, from Columbia to Dartmouth to Princeton to other institutions on the East Coast, all having significant trouble, and even having to go back home after having not gotten their authorization, even though they have a job offer waiting for them, because Citizenship and Immigration Services has taken so long. The average time now of processing is 5 months. And that's obviously outside the window of when they can potentially work. And that's that five-month window, certainly they only are given 90 days, and now the window of processing is 150 days. So that's obviously a major problem. So students, if they don't have flexibility in who they're working for, particularly if it's summer employment, the OPT over the summer is typically, you might as well forget it. It's not going to happen. Where it's really a challenge is for those students that have finished their degrees and are doing OPT as a post-completion OPT, where they might be doing it for a full year. I've requested a full year of work authorization, and now if that's getting pushed back, maximum they're going to have is 10 months if they have a flexible employer in terms of when they can start. So that really poses some significant hardships on students, and ones that certainly I've never seen it this bad in all the years that I've been in international ed. What I do see happening, though, perhaps, is if something like what happened post 9/11, there were because there were delays in processing visas at consulates and embassies because of extra security checks and everything that were going in place, that the maximum time students could apply for visas in advance of their program start date was increased from 90 to 120 days, up to 4 months in advance of when they might want to start. They could apply for their visas so that everything was in hand with plenty of time before they might need to come to the States. So that's the only way I see this changing, unless unless CIS staff all of a sudden magically figure out how to get through these backlog of OPT applications that they're dragging their feet on, who we don't know if it's part of a larger go slow approach that the administration is putting on international students. Certainly there have been moves recently that would suggest that this is they're favoring students in this situation who are graduating with degrees, and particularly advanced degrees, looking to work and opening the pathway to H-1B and potentially citizenship. Those things have been, there's been movements on that front, but there are certainly a lot on the negative side that seemed, in terms of rhetoric and past actions with travel bans and such, that seem to suggest that this might be part of a larger thing. But right now, DHS is probably the worst place that anyone would want to work, given the leadership changes that have been ongoing throughout ICE, HSI, through CIS, through SEVP over the last 3 years. That's really led to a lot of turnover and a lot of probably lack of direction and a lot loss of leadership and perhaps people who actually know what they're doing on decision-making processes. So I'm really sad to see this, frankly, and I don't see it changing anytime soon. But certainly it's going to be an issue that will impact international student offices for months to come, certainly this summer, and certainly unless changes are made to policies within CIS to alleviate the backlog of these OPT applications, It's really putting international students in a very difficult bind, and most particularly those students that are at the end of their degrees and are looking to begin a full year or longer of OPT work. So not too positive in terms of how this is going to resolve itself, but certainly it's one we've got to keep our eyes on, and certainly we'll keep you up to date here on the Midweek Roundup. The second story, shifting gears on a somewhat related topic, is related to the front end of the admissions cycle for international students, related to the initial degrees that students are applying for. Certainly one of the areas in international ed that has suffered dramatically over the last 3 years has been MBA programs. This article from Forbes that I've shared on the Facebook page has documented that 70% of full-time MBA programs have seen declines in applications. Some business schools are looking for solutions that are geared towards a very important demographic for international MBA programs, and that is international students. So overall, in addition to 70% of these full-time programs, and even the elite programs, MBA programs, are suffering in this latest environment they find themselves in. There's actually been an estimated 10% drop in international enrollments at nation's graduate schools of business between 2017 and 2018, which equals about 8,000 students fewer from overseas. So what are business schools doing? The heart where entrepreneurship apparently and innovation live in our society, and certainly in higher ed circles, they've also had to adapt to these changing circumstances. You see a number of programs, and there's ones that are listed here at Duke, at University of Rochester, and others that are now beginning to change the way their graduate programs are listed and giving them, ideally, STEM designation. And that now means they're incorporating more technology and data analytics into their MBA programs in order to qualify for STEM classification. Now, the process, this is something that I think any international admissions office, and certainly in discussion with their campus programs that are not already STEM, these are discussions that probably should have already started some years ago, when STEM first came out, and there were struggles and warning signs of how MBA enrollments were beginning to tip a bit. And Lou, thanks for joining today. Hope you're doing well at Unibuddy. For those who haven't heard of Unibuddy, I had a post in our newsletter this week, and they're a company out of the UK that's an online platform to connect current students at your institutions with prospective students. So kind of the ideal world for us in terms of what we hope all prospective international students get a chance to do, and that's connect with current students at your institutions. This Unibuddy is a platform started in the UK. They have gotten some traction here in the US in the last few weeks, but Unibuddy has just signed an agreement with UCAS, where that's going to be trialing that shortly for applicants to the UK, are going to be able to take advantage of connecting with current students at those institutions they're applying to through the Unibuddy platform. So interesting to see how that works. And Lou, good best of luck. I know you've got a few mountains to climb ahead, but looks like you got a lot of support on the back end. So I'm hoping that works out well for you. But back to the issue at hand with these MBA programs and what they're doing to diversify and innovate, looking to have STEM designation into their MBA programs with increased tech and informatics into their degree offerings. The challenge is, and as I mentioned, these are conversations that should have been happening beginning years ago when STEM was first introduced. But the reality is, in order to get, you can start offering degrees in those fields, but within SEVIS, the SEVP program, unless your institution has those new degree programs listed on your I-117, which is what you use to document all your programs through for the SEVIS system, that process, either through an amendment or through a research process where you're adding programs, that process can be 12 to 18 months before, after you submit an approval, a request for approval or a research, that process you can't advertise or you can't do I-20s with these new programs until they're been approved by CIS, SCVP. And that means, it puts all institutions that want to innovate and are seeing the value in, we need to have more of our programs be STEM designates if we can, so we can be more attractive to potential international students. The current system is set up that it hurts institutions that are trying to do that because they can offer it domestically to whoever they want, but international students can't be admitted on those programs with a STEM designated degree until their research or their program amendment has been changed and approved by DHS. So this is a challenge, and one that I think the story does not touch on that, but it's certainly one that I think is a roadblock to institutions that are thinking outside the box and are trying to innovate as much as possible to improve their lot in terms of ability to recruit international students. So we'll be interested to see where that goes, but do keep an eye on that, because I'd be interested to hear how your colleges are diversifying their offerings in terms of perhaps looking to more STEM-specific programs that you can begin offering at your institution. So wondering how that will all work from the institutional end. Now, one thing I would like to kind of shift gears a little bit and talk about some of the successes out there in the wider world that we see. Certainly from the SMIE perspective, we see a lot of institutions that are looking to other countries and seeing how they're innovating and how they're positioning themselves. And truly what I think all organizations that are internationally minded need to be doing is, just a general rule of thumb, you need to be aware of your competition. And when it comes to international students, certainly one of the greater beneficiaries of some of the stumbles that other English-speaking countries over the last few years, one of the greatest beneficiaries of our failures for the UK, Australia, have all had issues in the last few years related to their government policies and incidents that happen in those countries. What we see happening is other countries, in particular Canada, have boomed. Part of my work, one of my consulting gigs, is with British Council IELTS, and I'm doing some video series on college admission updates in different countries, and doing research on Canada, Australia, UK, New Zealand, and in China and the US, and looking at some of the recent events and policy changes on the government level that are impacting how students or how international students are moving from country to country. And one of the clearest examples of a country benefiting from others' kind of downfalls has been Canada. North of the border, anyone who's been involved in international education has seen the stark contrast between the Prime Minister of Canada, Justin Trudeau, and Donald Trump in terms of their personalities, in terms of their outlooks on the world. We see very different characters and very different approaches to international education. And what my colleagues north of the border are doing, and one of the numbers I throw out fairly regularly is one I've just become aware of in the last couple of weeks, is now Canada's international population has quadrupled in the last 8 years, and that is really kind of an eye-opening piece in terms of the amount, and maybe that will quadruple in the next 8 years. I take that back, and it's actually looking at numbers from 2013 to 2022. the actual numbers and how they're reported is kind of the nature of this particular story I'm talking about, and that is how are students counted, international students counted, not only in our country. We rely on, we have two different kind of competing sources, either the CVS figures that we get from Department of Homeland Security that are pulled direct from the CVS database, which is supposedly real time and captures current students where they are, or do we rely on Open Doors? Until CVS was really introduced and these reports were generated by DHS, all we had was really Open Doors data that we knew was a year old. So that comes out in November, that covers the previous academic year. And those numbers certainly gave us context for where international students are. But in Canada, there's a couple different sources as well. One is the CBIE, Canada Bureau of International Education, and the other is Immigration Refugee Citizenship Canada, IRCC. My colleague at HESA, Higher Ed Strategy Associates, Alex Usher is his name, out of Toronto. He's very, very much a big thinker. I've profiled some of his work here on the Midweek Roundup before, and certainly he has a very keen eye on what's going on in Canada and knows the system certainly far better than I ever do, or can. But he kind of walked me through some of this, and a couple of the articles that he's written recently, I've just posted the links to. Interesting to see where they're going. But if you look at numbers in 2018. The numbers from IRCC were 570,000 students, international students in Canada. Now, how that's counted, what that counts, counting language students, high school students, as well as vocational college or community college, as well as university level study, he says it can cover all of those, that number. And that, he says, that's the number of student visa approvals, not necessarily all those international students that were in Canada that particular year. Because we look at other figures, other sources like Project Atlas, and that number for 2018 reflected only 370,000 students. So that's a pretty significant difference of 200,000 looking at the same year's capture, 200,000 student number difference. So fairly significant, because the article that I referenced, and I put it in the it was a Pi News article, actually, a couple weeks ago, had that in our newsletter, and I shared that with Alex, and he wrote this piece in response to that. He says that the projection in the article was that Canada is going to have 1 million international students by 2022, based on the current projections. So if that's true, obviously they would overtake us in the United States. So I don't necessarily see that happening, because there are a lot of other issues, I think, in Canada that will prevent just the sheer capacity issues that they have. If you look at Canada, they are sitting on, from the Project Atlas data, one of the most fascinating ones I look at is the international students as a percentage of total higher ed. And if you haven't seen the Project Atlas data, it's certainly good to get a sense of your competition. I definitely recommend doing that. Canada right now, as of 2018, sat at 18.3% of their international student enrollment was coming from international students. And that, when you look at the U.S., is only at 5%, well, just less than 5%. And Australia is upwards of 32%. And the U.K. is at 21%. So we're looking at countries, Canada is third on that list for percentage of its higher ed population that's international. You get to, particularly in certain schools, particularly at the college level and the vocational college level, you're starting to see examples of those in Canada where they are chock-a-block with international students, 40, 50, 60% international, and there's some negative impacts of what those numbers are meaning for their domestic student populations, for their overall campus dynamics, have led to some issues in Toronto with some of these colleges where students can actually work off campus up to, I think, 20 hours a week, but you see them working regularly 40, 60 hours and are getting deported as a result of that. So there's a lot of issues there that I think will be important to keep an eye on as Canada goes through some growing pains with the international students that they have at their institutions. The final story related to that that I want to share is with regards to another quick piece that Alex wrote on danger ahead, talking to Canadian institutions. And he has this great turn of phrase here that I want to share about the reasons for Canada's success internationally. And it's with the international student enrollments have just boomed. He says that success has brought Canadian institutions billions of dollars and allowed them to make up for roughly a decade of domestic tuition fee controls and stagnant core provincial funding. So similar stories to what we see on the state level, you see impacting why state institutions in the United States have been forced to go international as much as they have because of declining state funding and limited increases to their domestic tuition. So they were looking at out-of-state students and international as key markets. But what the phrase that I like that really really stuck home for me is he kind of equates much of Canada's success to failures in other key English language speaking markets in the UK, in Australia 10 years ago, UK 5 years ago, US currently in the last 2 to 3 years. That our failures in these other major English language speaking countries have led to Canada's success as kind of a default. Well, if we can't go to these three places or if they're not as attractive, Canada looks welcoming, let's go there. So that's Alex's take on this. And what the phrase that he uses here, and I'll read this sentence quoting him, all of which makes Canada, when it comes to international students, the classic case of the kid born on third base who thinks he hit a triple. So this is kind of equating that to the kind of dumb luck piece that I was referencing earlier. But certainly there's quality north of the border. There's no doubt about that whatsoever. And many good colleagues working at Canadian institutions will be quick to rally to the defense of their institutions. And their university-level folks are probably the ones least impacted by Alex's statement, because I know for a fact that they, as institutions, have been active internationally, have been engaging in diversification of their international student populations, have been on the road in South America for 5 to 10 years, have been actively engaged in the Middle East and India for over a decade. And those are institutions that are doing it right and are developing relationships, have excellent counselor networks. But for what Alex is talking about, I think, is those institutions that have just become quick outlets for like 10 years ago when vocational education in Australia was taking a hit because of some unscrupulous agents that were funneling thousands of students to Australian vocational schools. Now those are coming to Canada. What could be said for universities and other two-year colleges and three-year colleges in Canada that have benefited since the UK's policies took a turn 5 years ago. Now, in the last 2 to 3 years, you've seen MBA applicants from India, from Vietnam, flooding into Canada, whereas they might have normally previously come to the United States. So you see a lot of movement, obviously. But that is as a result of, okay, well, can't go here, we got to go here. They seem more friendly than what the other options are. So let's think about these things in a more of a holistic way when we approach international education. I think when we do that, we are giving ourselves a better advantage as institutions, as international educators, to be able to approach the issues that we face on a day-to-day basis much more easily. So thanks again for joining us this week's Midweek Roundup. And again, we podcast these and make them available on our YouTube channel for SMIE Consulting. I hope you get a chance to follow up with me on any of the stories that are of interest to you. But please, if you do nothing else, subscribe to our SMIE e-newsletter. And that's all the SMIE news fit to share. Hope to see you soon and look forward to seeing you at upcoming conferences. Cheers.